Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to New Books in the American West, a channel on the New Books Network of podcasts. I'm Stephen Hausman. I'm an assistant professor in the history department at the University of St. Thomas in St. Paul, Minnesota, and I'm your host for this interview. And today I'm speaking with Andres Resendez. Dr. Resendez is a professor of history at the University of California, Davis, and is the author of many books and articles, including The Other Slavery, which won the 2017 Bancroft Prize, among other accolades, for the best book in American history. Today, we're going to be discussing his newest book, Conquering the Pacific, An Unknown Mariner and the Final Great Voyage of the Age of Discovery, which came out with HarperCollins in 2021. Welcome to the New Books Network, Andres. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much. Good to be here, Steve. A pleasure.
Why don't we start, as we always do here on the New Books Network, by just hearing about who you are as an author. I'm curious about your background, and I'm especially interested in how you first became interested in history.
Sure. So I grew up in Mexico City. As you may know, Mexico is a very historically conscious kind of a country, or you could almost say historically obsessed. So I grew up socialized in that world, even though I studied international relations in Mexico, and I got a little bit of history, a little bit of law, a little bit of political science. Nonetheless, history became my great love, and I did a PhD at the University of Chicago in the U.S. and went back to Mexico, worked a little bit more as a historical consultant for soap operas. So that was a great way to support my dissertation writing by sitting down with script writers and feeding them information, and they would turn this into dialogue and scenes that then would appear on TV. So that was the best job ever. So that's sort of how I came to history in very broad terms.
I have so many questions about your time as a historical consultant for soap operas. We'll leave those for another podcast, but that sounds like truly fascinating work right there.
Yes, it was great.
Yeah. Thank you. I'm curious also what brought you to the topic of this book. I mean, over the course of your writing career, you've covered many different topics, and what brought you to this one?
Right. So very early on, I became very interested in the early colonial history of the of Mexico's far north and what is now the American Southwest. Especially I was very fascinated by the early exploration stories. And I got a little bit of information about these Afro-Portuguese pilot who had been the first to sail across the Pacific. And yet, in spite of this accomplishment, he had been secretly judged by a group of officials in Spain, in Mexico, and then sentenced to die as payment, as a reward for his incredible effort. So I was always drawn to this story. I knew very little at the time, so I promised myself that once I got tenure and I got a little more stable position, then I would go back to this story and really try to get to the bottom of it.
We were chatting a little bit before we started recording that I really enjoyed this book. And one thing I enjoyed about it is that it's such a page turner. It seems like it's very much written with kind of a broad audience in mind. Was that a conscious choice on your part? Just wondering.
Yes. I mean, if I look back on my career, so I started with an academic book on the history of the U.S.-Mexico borderlands in the 19th century. Then I really wanted to straddle to do something hybrid between academic writing but gaining more readers outside academia, and so I did an early book on a 16th century expedition that did fairly well. That book led me to the other slavery that you mentioned. My pattern is I look for an exciting story into a broader theme. So this is what has happened. So I started with this book about the early exploration of the Pacific, and now I'm currently involved in another book about the consequences of that regular contact across the Pacific. So I think it has been my pattern in the last four books, I guess.
Yeah, this is the kind of book to anyone listening who has a historically minded friend or relative. This is a great gift kind of book, honestly. It's the kind of book anyone could enjoy. And one of the things I liked so much about it is, you know, I'm an environmental historian, and while this book does not really market itself as an environmental history, it kind of sort of secretly is to me. At least I thought so. I mean, the Pacific Ocean itself is such a character, is such a historical actor in this book. And I'm wondering if we can maybe begin, like you do in the book, by just describing the Pacific Ocean itself. So I'm going to ask you to do a difficult task. Can you describe this mammoth ocean and its history to us in just a couple minutes? As you say in the book, there's this great line. You said the Pacific, it's not like just any other ocean, right? It's sort of its own entity. So how is that the case?
Right. Well, I mean, it is a bit of a strange twist of fate that we are so centered on the Atlantic because, of course, I mean, and rightfully so, because the colonization of the Americas occurred from Europe, and because of the tragic history of the transatlantic slave trade, we are very focused on the Atlantic. But the Pacific is twice as large as the Atlantic. It is far more difficult to navigate. And it has, you know, for millions of years been for tens of millions of years been the most formidable obstacle to the movement of plants, animals, germs, ideas, and humans, of course. I began thinking about that more fully because, in addition to everything else, I have a little sailboat, and you know, here in the Bay Area, in California, and so very early you realize how limited you are in your scope and how easily you can get into trouble, even just in the Bay Area or just getting outside of the Bay Area. And so it was an incredible realization about those 16 or 15 or 16th century expeditionaries or pilots who, armed only with a compass and the most rudimentary maps, were able to tackle this enormous, daunting obstacle that existed on planet Earth.
And some of those obstacles are these massive currents and gyres that just churn things up and send things in all these crazy directions in the Pacific. And that's sort of a major obstacle and a major part of the book. Can you describe briefly the kind of process behind these currents in the Pacific?
Sure. These gyres occur in different oceans of the world. So there are two of them, two main ones in the Atlantic, the North Atlantic Gyre and the South Atlantic Gyre. And the same thing happens in the Pacific. So it was, I tried to provide some context in the book by offering how some of the great discoverers of the Atlantic, like Columbus and Magellan, became aware of these gigantic wheel of wind and currents that essentially enabled them to journey from Europe to the Americas and back. And you know, Magellan was probably the first one to theorize that if that happened in the Atlantic, it probably also existed in the Pacific. These gigantic wheels are fairly regular because they occur because of the movement of the Earth. The spinning of the Earth is what creates this, along with the general outlines of land masses in the world. So he correctly predicted and used some of this. So clearly the story of successfully going from the Americas to Asia and back hinged on understanding this gigantic gyre. So the Pacific was not a blank desert as you would see from the deck of one of those ships, but it was actually a place alive with all these different currents and winds, and the ability to read those currents and winds made the difference between being able to go from point A to point B and embarking on a passage that was utterly impossible given the technology of the time.
So what is the deeper history then of people trying to navigate across this gargantuan ocean, of people trying to get across the Pacific? Because, you know, like we were saying a second ago, beyond just its sheer size, there's so much you have to know in order to travel across this ocean. What makes it such a difficult task, just beyond its sheer size? And why in the mid-16th century are people even bothering to try to do so?
Right. So first of all, the greatest adventure on the Pacific is one that we only have a few inklings of, and that is, of course, the great story that began maybe 5,000 years ago in the island of Taiwan from early explorers who, island hopping, ventured deeper and deeper into the Pacific. These required not only navigating successfully by the stars and being able to locate really tiny specks of land in the middle of a vast ocean, but also making a living in increasingly less viable environments. That is, as these pioneers from Asia ventured deeper into the Pacific, they encountered islands and little rocks that were devoid of any plants or animals capable of sustaining human populations. So they were both pioneers in the sense of locating these lands, but they were also pioneers in the sense of bringing some human-made environment to these islands, little by little. And so by island hopping, they were able to go 5,000 years ago from Taiwan through the very remote areas of Samoa, etc., and then by around the 11th and 12th centuries of our era, they embarked on these incredible pulse, you know, that they must have been able to solve all logistical and navigational problems. And they reached as far as Hawaii, as far as south as Rapa Nui or Easter Island, New Zealand, etc. These incredible voyages rank among the most remarkable feats of oceanic exploration in the world. And recently, and that is in 2020, we have gained additional insight into the likelihood that these Polynesians were probably able to either land on the Americas or meet Native Americans somewhere between the American continent and what is now French Polynesia, dating back to, as I said, the 11th or 12th centuries, and they were able to exchange a few very valuable plants like coconuts and sweet potatoes. So coconuts being an Asian plant, a plant that had been domesticated in Asia and had been extremely useful through the colonization of the Pacific, but was found by the earliest European explorers on the Pacific side of what is now Panama, so suggesting that they had landed before. And conversely, sweet potatoes, which is a vine from the Americas, domesticated maybe 4,000 or 5,000 years ago, those were found in Hawaii, Guam, et cetera, New Zealand, in pre-Columbian times. So clearly there was some sort of, there are all these little clues to these early Pacific story that we only know very imperfectly and through only this indirect evidence or DNA evidence. So the clinching piece of evidence is that these researchers based in Stanford and Mexico in 2020 published a piece showing that five different current contemporary Polynesian populations bear DNA markers from Native Americans. And they were able to, by sampling the frequency, I mean, we can go into a rabbit hole here, but by studying the frequency with which these markers occur, they were able to time their occurrence back to around the 11th or 12th century. So everything jives with the great Polynesian expansion of that era and the almost certainty of contact with Native Americans at that time. So that's the earliest great Trans-Pacific adventure that we only very imperfectly. We also, and I'm sorry that I'm taking so long to answer this, but of course, because it had been done through island hopping, that meant that only a few species from Asia ever moved to the Americas and vice versa. So it would require more technology and, you know, a revolutionary nautical technology that enable first European, especially Iberian navigators to really cross larger oceans. They started in the Mediterranean, then they graduated themselves into the Atlantic. And armed with these technology that we can talk about, they finally applied these new revolutionary techniques to the Pacific and were the first to be able to, from the middle of the 16th century on, to essentially go back and forth across the largest ocean on Earth at will almost every year.
Well, that's one of the things that I love about this story and about the history that you just told is that, you know, as much as these voyages that Europeans are taking are these incredible feats in all these different ways, you know, that they're sort of latecomers to this story, that people have been traveling around in the Pacific, including, you know, reaching the eastern coast of the Pacific for a very long time. So you put this story and the story of the age of discovery and of these European explorers into this larger context that makes it, you know, seem still pretty impressive, but more interesting and more nuanced. And I'm curious about these 16th century voyages, as we kind of zoom in more on the topic of the book. Why are Iberians and Europeans and people working for European empires, right? Why are they venturing into the Pacific at all in this period?
Right. So that was a story that goes back to Columbus and before Columbus. But basically what we have is two Iberian peoples, the Portuguese and the Spanish, that are different. They are they speak intelligible languages, very related languages. Their historical experiences were very comparable, very parallel. They were alternatively allied and at war with each other. They had all these dynastic connections, yet they were also locked in a long-term race over exploration of the rest of the world. And so the Portuguese, going back to an earlier question that you made, the Portuguese made some revolutionary discoveries in terms of the ocean circulation of the Atlantic. They started by essentially just exploring the coast of Africa, the coast of Western Africa. And by doing that, they understood something about the overall, these North Atlantic gyre that essentially essentially forced them into taking a leap of faith by the time they got to the bulge of Africa and letting themselves go very deeply into the Atlantic before turning midway into the ocean in order to return to Portugal. And this was called La Volta in Portuguese or La Vuelta in Spanish. And this is the maneuver that is at the heart of this book. Whether it's in the Atlantic or the Pacific, it's basically the same idea, which is that you really need to work with these enormous circular mass of wind and currents that are circulating around the world all the time. Going against those wheels of wind and current would have been absolutely impossible. So you just have to do that. And so the Portuguese were able to do that. They essentially trained a Genoese newcomer, Columbus. They admitted him into their midst. Columbus journeyed in the company of Portuguese sailors to what is now the coast of Ghana and to the Madeira Islands, etc. So he also became part of this technological achievement. But then Columbus came up with this revolutionary idea to reach the east by way of the west. An idea that was not that he proposed to the Portuguese monarchs and was not successful. So he then moved to Spain and proposed the same project. And we know the story very well of how the Catholic monarchs supported Columbus and the rest of history. But this is the point of departure for a story because the Portuguese immediately protested after Columbus returned from discovering these islands deep in the Atlantic, because the Portuguese rightfully so claimed that they had been the ones exploring all these islands in the Atlantic, and they considered Columbus as an interloper working for the Spanish crown. And so in order to keep the peace, they enlisted the mediation of the Pope, and ultimately signed a treaty, the so-called Treaty of Tordesillas, that essentially drew a line from the Arctic Pole to the Antarctic Pole, and passing, bisecting essentially the Atlantic into two spheres of influence. Everything to the right of the line would be assigned to Portugal, so giving, you know, a free hand to the Portuguese in what is now the coast of Western Africa and everything beyond that. And to the Spanish, everything that would be to the left of that line in the middle of the Atlantic. And that would give Spain a free hand in much of what is the American continent, except this little slice of Brazil, which jutted just to the right of the line. And so that explains why Brazil ended up being a Portuguese colony in the Americas. But the point for us is that arrangement worked more or less pretty well in the Atlantic, but the line continued on the other side of the world. And so that also divided at the time, it was extraordinarily difficult to measure longitude, so that is the east-west distance. It was easier to measure north-south distance or latitude. But nonetheless, there was an awareness that there was another line on the other side. And so the Portuguese, by continuing with the agreement and turning, rounding Africa and then reaching all the way to India, they finally burst into the Spice Islands and the Pacific. And the Spanish, after finding an opening between the Atlantic and the Pacific Ocean through Magellan, another Portuguese who defected from the Portuguese crown and helped immensely the imperial aims of the Spanish Empire, were able to start navigating the Pacific. And eventually these two powers met, the nautical powers essentially met once again, but this time in the distant Asian waters.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
I always love the story of the Treaty of Tordesillas, and just, you know, it says so much about European ideas about sort of the shape of and the map of the world, right? The fact that Portuguese gets this little tiny corner of Brazil, but they use that as an inroad to so much more colonization, right? And, you know, the fact that Spain has access to colonizing so much of the American continents, it's kind of a fascinating window into how they viewed the world at that moment.
Absolutely. And also breathtaking is that, so it's breathtaking in the sense that, I mean, these are two European powers negotiating, and they are, of course, not considering anything having to do with Africans or Native Americans
or anyone else.
Yeah,
of course.
but they are also negotiating and not taking into consideration any other European powers. So for these two, it's a win-win situation because it's dividing the world between themselves, regardless of what the English or the French or whatever may think. Obviously, they would have disagreed that this is the way the world should be divided.
I know, truly, the audacity of saying, all right, we got two halves of the world. You get one half, we get the other half, and that's it.
Yeah, problem solved, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So the narrative, as you tell it, really begins in the 1550s in a place that I will admit in my own ignorance and naivete that I had not heard of before starting your book. So we're talking about the mid-1550s in a place called Navidad. Can you set the scene for us a bit here, kind of put us in this place? Where are we? When are we? And what is the history and the politics of this place at this moment in time?
Sure. So we are at the point where the Spanish crown is seriously trying to open trade with the Far East, and they have exhausted all options. So the first navigator to go directly from the Americas to Asia is Magellan, but he was able to go there but not return. And so for the next decades, the Spanish crown essentially authorized several expeditions, at least half a dozen expeditions, to try to go and come back to be able to finally challenge the Portuguese monopoly over the precious spices and other goods that existed in the Far East. So this is the context in which it is happening. And so the crown finally decides to launch these elite expedition, no expenses spared, but it has to be done secretly because they don't want to bring about the hostility of the Portuguese monarchy. And so instead of choosing Acapulco, which would have been the logical place from which to build a fleet and launch this expedition because it was the closest one to Mexico City, which is where the Spanish viceregal authorities were centered. It had a lot of resources. It had a nautical tradition going on already. Instead of doing that, they tried to preserve some semblance of secrecy by choosing these godforsaken little harbor far to the north of Acapulco. And it was definitely a very gutsy choice and a very poor choice if you ask some of the mariners involved in this expedition, because first of all, you have to consider that it is very difficult to get from central Mexico to Navidad at that point. This is in the middle of the 16th century, as you're saying. So there's no this. So central Mexico is the area of the agricultural settled indigenous populations. Farther north, what you have are semi-nomadic or nomadic peoples who are producing less agricultural surpluses on which the Europeans could survive. And above all, they are engaged in hostilities with these European newcomers who are often taking over their territories because they are prospecting for silver at that point. So 10 years before this expedition that we're talking about, there was a massive insurrection in and around that coast. So not the best place to start, building ships or gathering people for an expedition to the Far East. So that was one problem. The other problem is that there were very few building materials in the Port of Navidad. So that created all sorts of logistical problems. So instead of using the resources available in and around Navidad, they had to bring nails, for example, all the way from Spain. They had to bring cannons. The artillery, which was very important, had to be brought all the way from Spain across the Atlantic. It had to be transported on carts through the Isthmus of Tehuantepec. It had to be then floated up the Pacific Ocean to these insignificant port in what is now the coast of the west coast of Mexico. So the expenditures were astronomical. So I estimated that the Spanish monarchy spent about 10 times as much in these expeditions as they had spent on the Columbian expedition just seven decades before. So clearly it was a choice out of necessity to try to keep this secret from the Portuguese, and the Portuguese eventually found out anyways, and at a great cost in a very rough area of the coast of Western Mexico.
Okay, so that's where we are. Let's talk about people. And the main character in this book is a guy named Lope Martin. What is his story? How does he end up in Navidad? And why is he so central to the narrative that you're weaving here?
Right. So Lope Martin is an Afro-Portuguese pilot. And that in itself requires some explanation. So Lope Martin came from the so-called Algarve region in what is now southern Portugal. So this was the preeminent maritime region in the world where the Portuguese fleets departed to all parts of the world, to Brazil, to Africa, to India, to Southeast Asia. So this was a very nautical area that required a lot of youngsters to enlist as essentially menial labor on the ships. This was a very harsh life, as you would imagine, in the 16th century. Only the poor, only the people who had to do it, had to, took up these expeditions. So Lope Martin is a man from a town called Lagos, in southern Portugal, as I was saying, which was a key stepping stone between Africa and Portugal, and a key stepping stone in the African slave trade at the time. So we know that Lope Martin's ancestors were African slaves. Who had, for reasons that are unknown to us, living in Lagos. But Lope Martin himself is described as a free mulatto with the language of the time. So he must have been enlisted as a young child, of 11 or even younger, into some of these ships. And he must have been just an incredible talent. He must have known exactly what to do aboard these sailing vessels. He was clearly a very resilient individual, very capable, very social, very personable. And so he rose through the ranks in these very difficult labor environment. But while it was possible for somebody, a person of color such as Lope Martin, to rise through the ranks to become a sailor, doing the next step, which is going from sailor to pilot, was a huge jump. And so I need to explain a little bit, because we may think of it as a continuum, but in fact, being the pilot of one of those 16th century expeditions was a huge step forward, a huge step up. So basically, the pilot was the heart of the enterprise. If you didn't have a good pilot, that would mean the difference between success and failure, especially at a time when you didn't have very good maps, where you really needed to know what to do in the face of storms, groundings, etc., shipwrecks, etc. So it was so important to have capable pilots that the Spanish Crown actually established a board to examine people wishing to become pilots. So Lope Martin not only rose through the ranks as a sailor, but also had the gumption, had the drive to undergo through this process of examination to become a licensed pilot, which was the highest occupation that somebody like Lope Martí could ever aspire to. And so that required owning your own charts, that required only owning your own instruments, and also being able to establish your position while in the middle of the ocean without the sight of land. And most crucially, it required demonstrating that you were a person of good character, which we don't know how Lope Martí was able to demonstrate that, especially given that he was variously described as a mulatto. Lope Martí was not the only mulatto, but there were only very few mulatto pilots at the time in the 16th century. Most pilots and commanders of the era are white European of Christian background. As you know, in the mold of Columbus, Magellan, et cetera, et cetera. So we don't know exactly how that happened, but he must have been extraordinary. Maybe his characteristics as a great mariner overcame some of the drawbacks that he had socially. And more importantly, he needed to demonstrate that he was also a Spanish by birth, and he was a Portuguese. So in his application, he claimed that he was from the town of Ayamonte, which was the town right on the Spanish side of the border, right next to Portugal, which we know it must have been a lie, because we know from other sources that he was from Lagos, deep in Portugal. But this was one common way in which Portuguese, very talented Portuguese pilots kind of got around the regulation about being Spanish and ended up being being accepted as one of the licensed pilots of the Spanish Empire. The last word that I'm going to say about this is that Lope Martí must have been one of the preeminent pilots of his time, because as you would imagine, this was a crucial expedition for the Spanish crown, arguably the most important expedition of that era. It was to open trade with the Far East. And the Spanish crown was bent on recruiting the best possible pilots, the best possible crews, building the largest ships ever built up to that time, getting the best of everything to finally be able to go to Asia and return successfully. And Lope Martí was amongst the select few pilots, which again, as we said, pilot is the heart and the spirit of the ship, that was hired for these very high stakes, secret, no expenses spared kind of an expedition.
All right. So on November 20th, 1564, these four ships set off from the secret port, set off from Navidad to cross the Pacific. Can you tell us a little bit about how they prepared for this voyage and then what happens in the pretty eventful first few days after they set off across the Pacific?
Sure. So the expedition took years to put together. They had to start from building the ships, recruiting all of these people, etc. But finally, when everything was ready, these four ships, two very large ships of 500 and 400 tons, respectively, and then two smaller ships, departed from these minuscule, godforsaken town of Navidad. In the wee hours, maybe at 3 a.m. in the morning. Why they left at that time is baffling to me. But they departed on these imperial expedition that would change the course of history. Things went well for about a week until there was a storm in the middle of the ocean. The plan had been that the expedition would stick together, that the four ships would more or less stay within sight of each other, that during the day they would communicate through signals, through flags, etc., and at night they would put lanterns in order to know where they were, but. In an era prior to radio communication, it was very easy for expeditions to get separated, and this seems to be what had happened. Even before that, there had been some disagreements, and I don't know if we really need to go there, but we could. About exactly what route the expedition should go, because one of the subplots of the whole book is that we have these remarkable Afro-Portuguese pilot, Lope Martin, who is one protagonist, but another protagonist is a no less fascinating figure, who is one who had navigated the Pacific for 40 years at the time. So he was the doyen of the Pacific navigators, if you will, who had nonetheless decided that he'd had it in the world of exploration, and he had entered an Augustinian monastery. And it was only the king who had explicitly sent a letter saying, "We want you in this expedition," that finally persuaded this man, Andrés de Urdaneta is his name, to leave the monastery and enroll in this expedition. And he, because of prior experiences in the Far East, he had very clear ideas of where they were going to go. And so there is this little subplot going on between Lope Martin and Andrés de Urdaneta. But I mean, the point is, they got separated. Lope Martin was the pilot of the smallest of the four vessels in the fleet. It was also, some of the other vessels had not one, but two pilots, so that they could check each other. The larger vessels obviously had a lot more water and a lot more food and weapons, whereas the smallest of the four ships had fewer of those resources. So what happened is that, 10 days into this expedition, so at the very beginning, so let's just remind our listeners that it took about 3 months of sailing to go from the coast of Mexico all the way to the Philippines. So this was the very beginning of the expedition. This fleet became separated, and the three largest vessels stuck together, and the smallest ship, piloted by Lope Martin, kind of became separated from the rest of the expedition.
What on earth was life like on these vessels as this voyage stretches into weeks and then months? There's one thing that you say in the book and that you mentioned a little bit earlier that, if you or I were on one of these vessels and climbed up into the crow's nest or what have you, we would probably see this like endless stretch of ocean that would just look, I mean, maybe not you because I know you sail, but to me anyway, it would look very just sort of like a blank slate, right? But as you were saying before, these pilots and these people on these ships, they can read these currents, right? They know exactly what is happening. They see things that someone like me would never see on this ocean. So can you describe a little bit about what life is like when they're actually traveling across the Pacific? What kind of risks, what kind of dangers, and what people are they encountering along the way?
Right. So luckily we have some very detailed logs kept by the pilots and some other accounts by some of the passengers that we can rely upon. But, well, first of all, you have to imagine a mid-sized apartment in New York City with about 100 people, with only one bathroom and no kitchen, to get a sense of just what it is, and to be able to live here for 3 months. This is basically what it took. There were no beds, for example, or rooms, certainly no rooms, except in the most extraordinary circumstances for the pilot and the captain, and maybe a couple of other royal officials. But basically, when it came to sleeping, you had to find some reasonably level surface on which you could sleep. When it came to eating, this was regimented. This was done two or three times a day. And basically what you would have are pages or, servants coming up with large platters of food. And people essentially, there were no, so forks were only being diffused into Spain and Portugal at the time and many other parts of Europe at the time. So people carried their own knives, but they didn't have forks. Also, they would use their hands to cut pieces of meat. For example, if it was meat, more typically they would eat hardtack, bizcocho, which is an unleavened bread that was very, very hard. You would soak that in water or wine, if you had it, in order to eat it more with greater comfort. So this is basically but the rations were appropriate, so they were not starving on the way there. That will change later on, as we will see. And the water was appropriate on the way there. So that this sort of is more or less what it would look like.
And, keep going.
It occurred the last part of your question. So after weeks on end of seeing absolutely nothing, we need to remember that this is the loneliest part of the planet, basically. They started encountering these little islets and atolls in the middle of the ocean. And they must have been irresistible. So we have some drawings by some of the pilots of these little atolls during this expedition. And they must have been irresistible. So here you have, you've been traveling for weeks, you've seen nothing, and then all of a sudden you see what resembles a corral. They called it, many of these pilots and servants, etc., they have an agricultural background, the image that comes to their mind is a corral in the middle of the ocean where they could possibly stop. They could go into calm waters. They are liable to be a lot of fish. They could get some. They could stretch their legs. Finally, they could sleep in the sand for a little while and rest and regain their strength. They could potentially find some water and replenish their water stops. Yet doing that would have been extremely dangerous because they didn't know how the ground looked like. If they could get stuck in one of these atolls or these little islands, it could be catastrophic. They would die. These were uninhabited little places. So however enticing, they bypass some of these early atolls, et cetera, et cetera.
So the expedition reaches the Philippines at the end of January in 1565. Specifically, Lope Martin reaches the Philippines in January of 1565. What are the expedition's experiences in that archipelago, and where do they go next?
Yes, so by that point, they are months into this expedition. They are running out of water, and they are running out of food. And they, even though they have tried to reconnect with the rest of the fleet, they have been unable to do so. So they find a good cove, a protected cove, and they land there. They don't know if the inhabitants of that place are going to be friendly or hostile, but they end up establishing contact with some Filipinos. They begin trading. They establish friendly relationships at first, and they began trading. It turned out that many of these Filipinos were really interested in iron, which the Spanish ships carried in excess. You always need some extra nails, et cetera, to make repairs. These material was very prized by the Filipinos and by other islanders of the Pacific. So they were able to receive a lot of food in return for that. So that was the initial basis for the exchange. But as they stayed for a month, they are beginning to be resented by the local peoples. The Spanish no longer have anything of interest to trade, and yet they remain there. And in the meantime, there is internal dissension in the ship about what's the best course of action. And again, it's basically the alternatives are very stark. They either continue searching for the rest of the fleet, or they could try to sail to one of the Portuguese forts that is in the area. So remember, Portugal by way of India and the spice, you know, India and Indonesia, etc. They had been able to establish some forts in the Spice Islands, which were not too far from the Philippines. They're due south from the Philippines. And they knew the location, you know, the expeditionaries, Lope Martin and others, knew the location of these forts. So they could try to reach one of those and surrender to the Portuguese crown in spite of the whole rivalry between Spain and Portugal. At least they would be able to survive if they did that. Or the third alternative was to try to return, to follow through with their mission from the start, to find the elusive vuelta, the elusive return voyage. And so they are faced with this complication.
And as we were saying before, prior to this period, no Spanish navigator had ever successfully conducted a west-to-east traversal of the Pacific. So what happens on this very eventful sixth attempt?
So in the end, there is some dissension, etc., but Lope Martin, and who is the pilot, and the captain, Alonso de Arellano, who is a nobleman who knows very little about matters of the sea, but nonetheless is the captain, as it was customary at the time. Captains were not necessarily really trained individuals. These were plum jobs given to noblemen, etc. They decide that they are better off, that they are going to try to gamble by going back. And the odds are extraordinary because, as you mentioned, the Spanish had really tried to do that several times before, and they had failed every time. They had tried with much larger ships. The San Lucas, as the vessel is called, was one of the smallest that ever tried the return voyage. And worst of all is that because they had spent months in the Philippine archipelago trying to reconnect with the rest of the fleet, their stores of food were going down, and their stores of water were also going down. And this requires a little context. So basically, what the San Lucas did was to go right through the middle of the Philippine archipelago, looking for the rest of the fleet, and they failed to do that until they reached the end of the archipelago. And at that point, they faced very strong currents that were essentially taking them out of the archipelago and into the open ocean. And so they, at that point, while they are away from land and unable to replenish their water, they are faced with this terrible dilemma of either, are we going to really try to go against the wind and the current and do our utmost to try to return to land in order to get some water? Or are we going to use these conditions pushing us towards the Americas, and are we going to risk it even though we don't have full stores of water and full provisions as we want? And so, and ultimately there was a big discussion, but ultimately the faction that wanted to follow through with the Vuelta, with the return, prevailed, and that's how this expedition got underway.
So what happens in the end? In particular, I'm curious, what becomes of this whole story, and why does Lope Martin become, in the words of this French historian that you quote in the book, a merely anecdotal person in the history of the Pacific and early Imperial Spain?
Right. So so what happens is that they... So first of all, I should provide the context that going from the Americas to Asia had been done since the time of Magellan, and it was fairly well understood that it was possible to do because you had favorable winds and currents. Returning was a different matter because they didn't really know exactly where those favorable winds and currents were, but essentially it required to go way north from the Philippines, to go almost straight up close to Japan to catch another part of the North Pacific Gyre that brushes up against the coast of Japan and continues deep into the Pacific. But this was only speculated about, only mildly understood. And you also needed to do that, to do this travel northward at the right time of the year, because the currents and the winds shift because of the monsoon. People normally associate the monsoon with the Indian Ocean, but the Asian monsoon, in fact, spills into the Pacific. And so knowing exactly when to take advantage of those winds was absolutely essential. Somehow, we don't really know exactly how, but Lope Martin seemed to have been aware of when to embark and how to do it. And so he was extraordinary, because we at least have one snippet of his reasoning where it is clear that he's aware of these conditions. So he embarks on these life or death attempt to return. It is a very tough return, because typically the return takes longer than the way there. Because they didn't have enough water, and because they didn't have enough food, they start suffering from that. So, for example, at some point they are running low on water, and then the rats that exist above the in the San Lucas start burrowing into the casks or the barrels of water remaining, and they perforate one of them and spill all the contents. So the water situation becomes even more critical. So the crew is forced to deploy 24-hour guards in order to protect the casks from the repeated attacks of the rodents, who proliferate there, and they sense that there's no other water but what exists in these few barrels of water. So that's one part of the problem. Also, the sails begin disintegrating, and so they are using sheets. They are using their own clothes in order to patch up the sails And finally, at last, they are able to emerge in what is now the coast of Baja California, and then make their way back to Navidad, where they are hailed as heroes for being the first to go to Asia and return successfully. And for a few days and weeks, they are celebrated and feted as real heroes. Lope Martin is this preternatural pilot, etc., the captain, Alonso de Arellano, etc., until the flagship of the rest of the expedition also successfully returns weeks later, and they level the charge of abandoning the rest of the fleet in the middle of the ocean to those aboard the San Lucas. And so that's how these drama becomes. And one of the things that I had fun doing is trying to prove that, in fact, there was a storm when the fleet separated, and it was not so that the charge was that the San Lucas had separated intentionally in weather that was perfectly fine, and there was no reason for doing so. So that's how that story unfolded.
So briefly, as we begin to wrap up the narrative here, what becomes of Lope Martin? As I was quoting a second ago, he becomes this kind of merely anecdotal character that you're trying to unearth and say, no, this was a truly real person who had a very important role to play here. What becomes of him in the end?
It's an incredible story, but he is, as I mentioned at the beginning, he is secretly tried and condemned by Spanish officials, but nonetheless, he's an extraordinary pilot. So what had happened with this expedition is that the Spanish had, in fact, established a permanent camp in the Philippines that needed to be resupplied. So even though some ships had been able to return to the Americas, immediately the Spanish Crown needed to organize a resupply expedition to go back to the Philippines to maintain those men who had remained, the Spanish hub that had remained in the Philippines. And what better pilot to lead this expedition than the extraordinary Lope Martin? But the plan was that he would, after returning to the Philippines, he would be tried by his own commander and probably hanged because of this accusation pending over him that he had abandoned the fleet on the first part of the voyage. So Lope Martin, I mean, if I had been Lope Martin, I would probably have had fled and tried to hide. But instead, the very able individual that he was, he took this as an opportunity. So he followed through the motions, knowing full well that he was not going to go to the Philippines to be tried by his former commander, the fleet commander. But instead, he was going to create turmoil and an insurrection, and he was going to take control of this ship, and he was going to change course. And remember, this is a time when if you could procure some precious spices from Asia and go back to Spain to sell it, you could make yourself fabulously wealthy. And Lope Martin had every capability to do exactly that. And so these are parts of the plan as he's sent again. You know, so he is able to stage a mutiny in the middle of the Pacific. That mutiny was neutralized by a counter mutiny. And so in the end, he and a couple of dozen of his supporters are left behind in an uninhabited island. And even though we don't have any direct evidence of what became of them, there is some direct evidence to support the idea that they probably survived. They intermarried with some of the indigenous peoples in the islands around this area. And which would be a very fitting end to the man who first navigated from the Americas to Asia and back and lived out the rest of his life right in the middle of the ocean that he had helped to understand how to navigate.
A truly amazing story. I'm curious here at the end. I always like to ask my guests a kind of a summary question. And I'd ask you to put yourself in the shoes of someone who has read your book and is maybe thinking back on your book, maybe a year or a few years on down the line. What do you hope that they would come away remembering or understanding from this book as they think back on it?
Well, two things. So first of all, that these expeditions of these voyages of discovery and conquest were not just by white Europeans, but they were incredible international expeditions. So the protagonist here is an Afro-Portuguese man passing as a Spaniard. And as I go in the book, the crew of this expedition was incredibly international. It included a person from Venice, a mysterious French pilot. So clearly, we are talking about very international expeditions put together. So it's not a Spanish versus the rest of the world or European versus indigenous. It's a very complicated story. So that's one. And the second is just a greater appreciation of what it took to actually go from the Americas to Asia and back successfully. Oftentimes, when we are, you know, when we are speaking as historians who are mostly living on land, we take for granted that people will be able to move from point A to point B in the ocean, no questions asked. But in fact, if you look closely at how it happened, you are really working with the elements. You are really working with the wind and the current, and you only have a compass and a very inaccurate map. And how people do that is incredible understanding of the elements, incredible skill, some luck, and a very human element. So that's why many of these early expeditions were so tumultuous. It involved so many disagreements, so many mutinies. I mean, Columbus, Magellan, and of course this expedition that finally opened the Pacific. So those would be the two main ones.
That second one in particular really made an impression on me. I was, you know, reading about all these accounts of what they were going through and thinking, like, man, better them than me. Like, keep me on land.
Yeah.
So finally, Andres, I always like to get a preview from my guests about what they're working on next. And you alluded earlier to a new project that is kind of furthering your understanding and kind of going deeper into the history of these sort of Pacific connections between the west coast of North America and the east coast of Africa. Can you Asia? Can you give us a preview of what your next project might be?
Sure. So these expeditions that we just talked about open the door to yearly expeditions that unfolded over the next 250 years, yearly expeditions. And these transported many different goods across the Pacific. So just to give you some examples, so it carried some highly productive crops from the Americas to Asia, and these helped in the population boom of China, for example. And I'm talking about things like corn and sweet potatoes that really landed in Southeast Asia, moved into China, and really transformed China, which was already 25% of the world's population in 1500, and turned it into an overwhelming 36% of the world's population by 1800. So one in three humans alive lived in this smallish part of the world. Conversely, China, because of some monetary changes, went from paper money to silver as a refuge. China had some silver, but not nearly enough. And so this Chinese demand for silver transformed the new world into a silver-producing operation. So the colonial history of Latin America would have been drastically different had the Chinese decided to use gold or some other metal rather than silver. So I look into these interactions. And of course, I try to carry this story to the United States as well. So the first 250 years were courtesy of the Spanish Empire. But then the United States, which up until, you know, the 1780s had been an Atlantic, set of colonies, burst into the Pacific and very quickly became significant providers of China of a few goods. So I go into that. And so how these, so basically the larger idea is how the Americas transformed China and how China transformed the Americas. So that's from the 16th century when trans-Pacific contact became possible to the middle of the 19th century.
Andres Resendez is a professor of history at the University of California, Davis, and he is an acclaimed author of many books, and his newest is Conquering the Pacific, An Unknown Mariner and the Final Great Voyage of the Age of Discovery, which came out with HarperCollins in 2021. Thanks again for joining me today, Andres.
Thank you so much, Steve. A pleasure.